syllabus, I realized that when I made it, I had somehow missed the fact that Monday was a holiday. Worse still, for some bizarre reason, after discovering that fact, I thought that Tuesday was one of the official Mondays that they have here just to confuse us from time to time, with the result that at 2:40 yesterday, I walked into this room only to discover that the students were waiting for Dorothy Clancy's class on privacy. So,
you are having an official switch sometime later.
Yes, I know. I'm not very good at keeping things organized. So I hope you have actually read both the stuff that I had assigned for the non-existent class Monday, which is, I think, one of the more interesting chapters in the book, and the stuff for today. So I wanted to start by seeing if you had any questions on the course mechanics, so to speak, then go on to that to questions on matters of substance. So everybody understands what you're supposed to do, when, how. You all have great, clever ideas for papers you want to write that will teach me lots of interesting things, and you all intend to have drafts of those papers in by, I think, April 2nd, if I remember correctly, or some such date that I have on the syllabus. All right? No questions. Good. All right. What about the stuff that we've just been reading? Before I go on to sort of give my canned summary, which you don't really need because you've read it all and you've read the chapter, what are the things in the stuff you've read that you'd like to talk about that you thought were interesting or puzzling or that you had clever ideas about making sense of or any of that stuff? Yeah?
The two chapters you found us reading through this week have two different interpretations of why One has
I know less about the subject of the people who wrote those chapters. That is, the conjecture offered in chapter 3, which seems to me a reasonable conjecture, but no more than that, is that the original system was some version of feud. And as some support for that, one of the patterns I think we'll see as we go through the course is that feud does seem to be sort of a fairly natural base legal system. That Icelandic law, and as far as I can tell, early Germanic law in general is really a feud system of some sort. That includes Anglo-Saxon law. Somali traditional law is a feud system. And as I think I commented before, both Islamic and Jewish law look as though they are built on sort of the fossilized remains of feud systems. So that in Jewish law, you've got this business about the cities of refuge and the avenger of blood, which sounds as though originally when you killed somebody it was the obligation of his kinsman to kill you. And then they had various rules to regularize and restrict that. And in Sharia, the part of Sharia that deals with death and injury, oddly enough to us, is private rather than public law. It's in the form, basically, of what are the rights of the injured party or the kin of the person who's been killed against the person who has killed or injured him. So that, at least if you look at what Sharia seems to say, it looks as though if you kill me and whoever is the responsible kinsman of mine doesn't mind, nothing will happen to you. Now, whether that really is true, I don't know. One of the things you'll see as we get into Islamic law is that you have sort of this formal structure of Sharia, but then you've got a bunch of other legal systems sitting, sort of running around it with, as with Jewish law, with sort of the excuse that the official religious law isn't enough and we've got to fill in the holes to make it work. But so for all I know, bad things really would happen to you if you killed somebody, even if his brother or whoever it was didn't mind. But at least under Sharia, it looks as though they wouldn't. So that makes it seem sort of plausible that the original Gypsy system might have been feud. And then the argument that's offered in Chapter 3 is that the feud doesn't work very well if you're tied down. That the costs of a feud system, when you don't have the option of leaving, become large. There's a book somewhere called, what's it called? Something Voice and Exit, Vote and Exit, something like that. It used to be a book assigned in colleges a long time ago. But it makes the interesting point that if you think about ways in which controlling institutions, that one way you control institutions is by formal democratic mechanisms, by voting. A different way is by persuading people by voice. And a third way is, you don't like it, you leave. And I like to argue that the best known form of government is competitive dictatorship. And the example of competitive dictatorship would be a restaurant. That I have no vote at all on what dishes are on the menu of the restaurants I go to. But I have an absolute vote on whether I go to them. And that seems to be a better mechanism for getting things to work, as it were, than voting or other similar mechanisms. It may not be an option for everything, but where it is, it works pretty well. So you could plausibly argue that in the case of feud, the combination of the threat of violence plus the option of exit works pretty well. Close down the option of exit because you can't leave because you're the property of a Romanian feudal lord. And now we say, well, that's not going to work. Got six guys killed last year. We've got to do something else. So that sounds plausible. Whether it's true, I don't know. That is the case of the Kali, of course, is that they were isolated from other gypsy groups for a long time. And I don't know, does Grundfos say whether we know where they came from originally? They originally came through Sweden, I guess, didn't they? But then, where did the Swedish gypsies come from? And does he say, I don't remember anymore, whether the Swedish gypsies have the Chris?
What? He said it was plausible that they were actually two entirely different, or an entirely different group from the Black Bronze, and that's why it seemed to be a parallel progress rather than...
Aha. Uh-huh.
And so the idea being that maybe the blood feud system in Finland was not actually the same one that the Chris had grown out of, that it was demonstrating.
Might.
The Swedish do have a Chris system.
They do. That was what I can remember. Yep. And are they? Do you know if the Swedish are part of the whole Vlachrom system? Are they one of the four Nazia? You don't know. All right. It'd be an interesting thing to research. I ought to look. I'll try to learn more about that question. But anyway, what I thought was neat about Chapter 3, and sort of is in a way neat about the whole gypsy experience, is where you start out with, it's sort of almost like a controlled experiment, you know. Take people of this cultural characteristic who have these weird rules they want to enforce, drop them in this environment, and what bubble up along, zip the Chris. Drop them in this environment, zip, feud, and then, you know, where they start, interesting question, yeah.
A little bit of history, curious, for me. The time frame on the Romanian gypsy enslavement seems to coincide with the time period when the Ottoman Turks were controlling. The Ottoman Turks take over Romania in like 1500, and they remain in control up until 1850 or something like that. And yet, this is a period that's called Romanian enslavement. So, who was doing the enslaving here? Are they Romanian landlords or
something? Romania is split, so there's the top section, which is where Transylvania is, and that was typically Hungarian.
Yeah.
The Hungarians were sent there as the Christian bulwarks against the Ottomans. The Ottomans, for the most part, were the lower part of Romania, where Bucharest is.
Transylvania, you're arguing, is free from Ottoman control, like, what, 1700 under Eugene of Savoy, perhaps?
Not arguing that. I don't know that much definition, but there's a natural divide between the two. Romania as a country wasn't even, you know, it was unified as three different provinces in about the late 1800s.
Yeah,
so there's this huge, that typically up there in the Transylvania, which is where most of a lot of this population lives, in Wallachia, which is where the word black comes from.
So the Romanian Jews are actually Transylvanian Jews, and actually more accurate.
Gypsies.
Sorry, gypsies. Yeah. They're actually more accurate.
Yeah, that's where actually there's a huge Hungarian population there now that's still trying to split away, and there's a huge German population there as well. So they're kind of held out under their own there, and they kind of had a different shared experience.
So Romanian gypsies is actually somewhat of a technical misnomer, or at least historical.
If your account is right, yeah, it may well be. But yeah.
I don't know about the time frames of the overlap. I know that it was always kind of an ebb and flow because obviously the Ottomans made it all the way up.
Yeah, well, for a while there's an Ottoman puppet kingdom of Hungary, as I remember.
Yes, there was. But I think that was, I want to say, 1500s?
Yeah, remember.
Before the second siege of Vienna.
Yeah, one of the neat things that I discovered reading about the Ottomans, by the way, is the usefulness of slavery for an expanding aggressive power. Because here's the situation. Here's the Ottoman Empire. Here are the people living around the Ottoman Empire. You are an ambitious, energetic, local leader inside the Ottoman Empire, and you say, I'd like to cross the border and go steal what those people have. Well, if all you can steal is gold and cattle and stuff, that's pretty hard, pretty easy to hide. But if you can steal people, that's really hard to hide. So it now becomes profitable to have raids across the border, which are weakening the surrounding territory. Raids which the Sultan doesn't have to pay you to make those raids, because you're making them for loot, which largely is slaves. And the result is that the areas around the border, A, become less prosperous and strong and able to defend against the next Ottoman push, and B, they aren't even sure they want to defend against the next Ottoman push, because if only they were inside the border, nobody would be raiding them. So I think it's sort of an interesting dynamic of the way in which the institution of slavery in the Ottoman Empire arguably contributed to its success as an expanding imperial power for a while. Yeah,
yeah, I'm curious. I'd be curious to know more about the experience of gypsies in
the Ottoman Empire.
In the Ottoman Empire. Because I know, especially compared to Christian Europe, they're really good at, not assimilating, but they're really good at letting you keep your religion.
Well, they were Muslim.
Yeah.
That is the gypsies, still, there's still this distinction between the Muslim gypsies and the Christian gypsies.
Yeah, they're really, I don't want to say accommodating, because yeah. I don't know if that's the right word, but they did allow for a lot of the indigenous religions.
Well, the Ottomans.
Yeah.
You know, the Ottoman system is very interesting. I don't have a chapter on it, but I think I do mention it in a later chapter. And that's the Ottoman millet system. That basically the Ottoman system was that lots of different religious and ethnic subgroups essentially were self-ruling within the Ottoman Empire, provided that they paid their taxes and didn't make any trouble. And in fact, their leaders were subsidized by the Sultan. So that if you were the bishop or whatever who was the titular leader of some Christian subgroup in the Balkans, you probably had a pension from the Sultan.
They actually had to contribute military units to the Ottoman Empire in times of war as well.
Well, and of course, they recruited the sort of slave soldiers from the Christian population also, but the janissaries.
Each individual's group had to divide and call upon their military units.
But no, the Ottoman, I think I've had, I'm not sure I've had a good paper on the Ottomans yet. The Ottomans are certainly one of the very interesting historical societies. It would be nice, I did have one paper which had some interesting stuff on it, but which it might be nice to know more about. But in any case, you know, I don't know, that is, it's clear from this book that you've got a distinction between the Balach Ram and the Muslim Ram. That sort of is one of the common splits. But I don't know very much about what the Muslim Ram are. Do they have the Chris? I don't know. You would think not if Chapter 3 is right, but it doesn't actually discuss it. It's sufficiently, if you think about, imagine that you're researching the Roman child. It's going to be years worth of work to get to know people, to get them to trust you, to figure out what's going on. You're not going to do that for 20 different cultures. And similarly, Grand Forest in Finland, very clearly what he knows is the Kali Gypsy, and he lived with them, and he, you know, knew their customs and so forth. So you do have a problem putting it all together. Yeah.
Well, it seems like it'd be hard to put it all together, because if you have such a nomadic people, they're going to exist in so many different people's practices at once, and that their experiences are going to be so vastly different that what they come out with at the end, it's all going to look like variants. It's hard to find the original forms.
Hard to find the original form, but you might again think of it as the experiment of controlling for sort of one set of things and then varying a bunch of others to see what happens. And that's where it would be nice if you sort of had a book like this three times as long with a chapter on each of 10 different. As I think I commented, one of the good sources I found on the Amish was a book which was just on the Indiana Amish. But Indiana was not the original area they settled, so you've got daughter groups basically from a lot of different settlements. And so he looks at this settlement and that settlement and that settlement. You're getting a real pattern of contrast of different alternatives. And I don't... Maybe that book is for the different issues, so I haven't found it. If any of you found... Because somebody I remember speaking to this fall said there was some kind of scholarly book on the gypsies which disagreed about the Chris being the later development. But I didn't actually find it. Yep.
So another bizarre thing about the Finnish gypsies is typically societies spend a great deal of effort creating kinship groups. And I mean, it's not just typically, it's universally societies celebrate marriage as a way to, you know, inculcate traditions and values of the new generation. The Finnish gypsies, by sort of turning their back on it explicitly and saying, we're not going to provide social customs for it, we're going to discourage it in all sorts of cultural ways. I mean, that's a suicidal strategy.
They're still there. Yeah, I mean, that's suicide. No, but notice, what they're not discouraging the acculturation of the young. They're still being brought up in the household.
Yeah.
What they're discouraging, arguably, is kinship bonds. That if you think about the way in which marriage is used, say, in medieval Europe, and in various other contexts, one very common way of making an alliance is I marry, I'm the king of England, and I marry my son to the daughter of the Duke of, you know, what was the famous example of own half France, more or less.
Burgundy.
No, that was a different case. But, Henry II's wife. Aquitaine, Eleanor of Aquitaine. There you got it, right. So you marry you marry the heiress of Aquitaine, or to take another example in about the same period, a very prominent Norman baron assists an Irish king in getting back his kingdom because his people don't like him very much, and marries the king's daughter, and the king dies without a son, and the result is that the daughter of Strongbow, who is a Norman baron, is the heiress to a quarter of Ireland, to Leinster, which is how William Marshall gets to be ruler of a quarter of Ireland, which, for those who are familiar with that bit of history, plays into the whole Richard the Lionhearted, John, etc. stuff. You know about William Marshall? Yeah, William Marshall is quite a neat character, but that's nothing to do with his course. He's a nice example of social mobility in the Middle Ages. He's born the fourth son of a minor baron, and before he dies, he's regent of England for John's son, having in between been the top tournament knight in Western Europe. A man who, I like to say, regarded Richard the Lionhearted as a talented amateur at medieval combat. Anyway. So that's a digression, but it's certainly true that a lot, and it's worth thinking about. I mean, your point, because a lot of societies do use marriage as how you get allies, basically, because now they're kin, his grandchildren are your grandchildren, and you'd like your grandchildren to turn out well, and so forth. And yet the Kali don't. The Kali pretty explicitly, the children are associated with one of the two households. I think with the mother's household, if I've got it right. And the husband is sort of a temporary husband. If there's a feud, he goes back to his own people. There's no implication of alliance between the two groups. Yeah, no, it's sort of interesting. I found an interesting comparison between the Kali and the Roman child, because it's a similar system, except the Kali are one level up in that it looks as though it's, rather than basically a single individual or a nuclear family, it's a slightly extended family, sort of, I think. One of the things that wasn't entirely clear to me reading that chapter is how many people are in that household, because it sounds as though it's more than... Yeah, it's clearly more than a husband and wife, but maybe it's husband and wife, their adult children, and their non-adult grandchildren. But at least it sounds as though the feuding is on a less individual level than among the Roman child, where it's really one person or person and his wife or something. But I thought that was very interesting. Other things that struck people about these systems they thought worth talking about? I'd much rather talk about things you'd like to talk about than go over the same stuff I've said about team. Time every other year. The sort of running down my standard outline, some of which we already talked about, all of these groups have an elaborate system of pollution. What's the function? One argument, at least, is that it's a way of drawing lines around the group and thus maintaining group solidarity. That one of the reasons to maintain group solidarity, I'm arguing, is if you want to run an embedded legal system, you need to have a way of punishing people within the group who break it, and how can you do that if they can easily defect to the outside society? Now, in some cases, the outside society may be hostile enough so you don't have to worry about that problem, but at least having your own rules makes it easier, and it also, in a certain sense, means your people can say it's not that they're rejecting us, it's that we're rejecting them, because they're filthy, unclean people who don't understand the rules of modern life. And, you know, a sort of an alternative theory, which isn't quite the same, is for some bizarre reason, something like Orthodox Judaism, kosher rules, maharame shows up. And once it shows up, it then acts to create a self-sufficient, stable over the long-term culture by sealing the people off from the rest. There's an interesting discussion, actually, which in a way is relevant to this, on the question of established religion. Any of you ever read the comments of Hume and Adam Smith on the subject of an established church? Yes?
I don't remember. I read them.
You don't remember. The neat thing is that Hume, who was widely believed to be an atheist, although he didn't actually say he was in favor of having an established church. Of course, the Church of England was the established church in England. Why did he want to have an established church? Well, said Hume, if church is not established, then the minister depends for his support on the enthusiasm of his congregation. And that gives ministers an incentive to stir up sectarian passion, to tell their people we're right and they're wrong, and therefore, you know, contribute money for, you know, if you think about really radio religious speeches nowadays, it's going to be the same pattern. How do you get money? By persuading people that you've got the true version. Whereas, if you have an established church, the minister is getting paid by the crown. How does he get the position? How does he get one of these valuable sinecures that people, if you read Jane Austen and people like that, people are always trying to get it? You get it by persuading the local aristocrats, the upper class people, that you're a good, respectable upper class type person, that you quote Latin in your sermons and probably put most of the audience to sleep because they don't understand Latin and you're talking about fancy, highfalutin things that only the educated minority care about. And, says Hume, the result is that nobody cares much about religion and you don't get any religious wars, and that's a good thing. And Adam Smith rebuffs this. And it's a wonderful passage just in terms of the tone of it, because Smith's explains Hume's argument. So says by far the greatest philosopher of the present day. And he then explains why it's wrong. And Smith's argument is that if you have lots of small religious groups, each of them has an incentive to make its members behave. Because each of them wants that group to have a good reputation. So if you say, if everybody knows that Quakers are people you can trust, that makes it valuable to be a Quaker. But that means that the Quakers have an incentive to put pressure on the other Quakers not to cheat, lie, steal, whatever. Similarly for each little group. And so Smith's argument is that it sort of provides a solution to the problem of how do you get a society in which you'll behave well. You do it by having small subgroups defined by these little religious sects, which you get if you don't have an established religion, each of which feels responsible for its own members, for the reputation of its own. So it's sort of a neat counter-argument, and you could argue similarly that one of the functions served by having well-defined groups is precisely to have group reputation. So one of the interesting puzzles in modern-day America is why it turns out that in certain places, certain industries are almost entirely monopolized by one ethnic group or another. And I no longer remember the list, but I've seen descriptions like, you know, maybe the donut shops in Los Angeles are all Armenian or something. I don't. That might actually be right. I'm not sure. It's some.
This area, the donut shops are all Cambodian.
Are they? Yeah.
And the small hotels are all Indian.
Yeah. Well, that's a very common pattern. And one explanation might be this culture somehow produces people who are good at running this kind of business. But another is that within the culture, people have mechanisms for knowing who to trust and who not to trust, and they're dealing with each other. And another possible one could be for some special activities that these depend on the outsiders trusting you, and therefore the members of the cultural group have an incentive to put pressure on each other to behave themselves. And
that would go along with Smith's idea, because Smith is not a philosopher.
Well, that's a little tricky. His first book was philosophy, his second book was economics.
Well,
yeah, theory of moral sentiments, though, is philosophy.
Hume was Scottish, right? Not English.
Both of them are Scottish.
Both of them, well, okay. Hume's Scottish.
Yes, of course, part of the Scottish Enlightenment.
Right, it was the Enlightenment, which was around 1700. Around the Battle of Cologne.
I think a bit after that, 18th century. Yeah.
Well, in any case,
he had
a great opinion
about religion. Uh-huh, yes. You know, Hume certainly was a very major philosopher, there's no question about that. But he was also a good friend of Smith's. And in fact, Smith got into some trouble by saying nice things about Hume's deathbed. He said they were friends, and, you know, since this was suspected that Hume was an atheist, and everybody knew that atheists were supposed to be terrified of death because they didn't have the prospect of heaven, and therefore saying that, you know, Hume died like a noble man, as it were, was thought of as a little bit risky. But anyway, but no, it's interesting. There's a wonderful letter from Hume to Smith when The Wealth of Nations was published. And Smith is in Scotland, and Hume is in London. And Hume is trying to pretend to Smith that he's got bad news for him. So he's writing this letter as if he's going to tell Smith that the book's been a complete flop. And he says, you know, such and such a Greek philosopher used to say that whenever he heard the audience applauding, he knew he had made a mistake. For wise men do not seek for the applause of the multitude, and so forth and so on. Now he says, about how your book is doing, damn it, a man is just coming to interrupt me. Long digression about the interruption. He then gets back to the subject. He's about to tell Smith how the book is doing. Another interruption. And after about three of these, he finally ends up saying the book is doing very well. So it's quite a charming letter. Yeah. Well, they were interesting people, that whole group of people. But certainly Smith was very interesting. And he was not a really good economic theorist. That's Ricardo a little bit later. But he knew an enormous amount, and he was a smart guy. Yeah?
I were asking another thing. And speaking of economics, the Finnish co-op gypsies are, according to the chapter, engaged in trade, and they do not trade with each other because they're regarded as a zero-sum game.
That's right. That's
so what exactly are the Finnish gypsies trading? They're not trading with each other. What are they trading?
Well, they're only a small part of the population. There's the rest of the population of Finland. But I don't know. There's horse trading, maybe, or hardware. Don't know. You'd have to... There is, I think, a book by Granfors, which I really ought to get and read, and which probably goes into a good deal more detail on that. I think I looked in the... We don't have in the library, though. I'm not sure. Our library has a surprising amount. I've suggested that the Jesuits are engaged in some form of black magic, by which they managed to have more of the books that I look for than they ought to, given the size of the library. But that was after I was looking for an Anglo-Saxon herbal, I think. And they not only had it, they had it in Anglo-Saxon with the English translation. But that had nothing to do with this course. Just sort of. But it is quite a good library. Anyway, one of the things that struck me actually looking at the whole discussion, it isn't just Feud versus Chris. Between the Vlach and the Romanchal, you seem to have a very different general set of attitudes. That the Romanchal seem to be sort of individualistic private property types, whereas the Vlach are much more a communal kind of society. And I wasn't quite sure how far you could push that discussion. I had some comments in here somewhere. Let me see if I can find them. Think about marriage. All right, the Romanchal, they steal their wives, meaning they elope. We steal our wives too, right? I mean, I didn't need my wife's parents' permission in order to marry her. I just needed her permission. And whereas the Vlacheron have nothing so disorganized as that. You know, you want a woman, you've got to go buy the right to marry her from her father. And that all of that seemed to be a system in which, on the one hand, people are thought of as belonging to themselves in the Romanchal system, and people were thought of as belonging to their parents or to the society in the other, and similarly, who are offenses against? In the Romanchal system, offenses are against persons. In the Vlach system, it's much more against the community. That the normal outcome of the kris isn't IOU damages. It's, I got to pay the cost of this kris you had, pay for the drinks and the food and such, to punish me for doing something that made the community worse off. And actually, it reminded me a little bit of an exchange on my blog not long ago where we got into the question of polygamy. I was sort of raising somewhat mischievously the question of how Mormon candidates for the Republican nomination would deal with the fact that a lot of people on the right who are against gay marriage say, well, look, if gays could marry, why, you could have polygamous marriages, and that's just horrible. Well, it's true the Mormon Church theoretically abandoned polygamy in 1890 and really abandoned it a few decades later, and nowadays doesn't believe in polygamy at all. But polygamy is part of its history. It's, you know, its founders were polygamists. So how is somebody like Romney going to respond if somebody says, do you think polygamy is just a horrible idea that we should believe in? And one of the commenters arguing against polygamy said that one of the reasons you shouldn't allow polygamy was that if men could marry multiple wives, then think of the four men left over with no wives. And he then went on to say that it just went along with the feudal idea of women as chattels. And it seemed to me it was exactly backwards. The idea of saying women have a responsibility not to be the second wife in order that they'll be available for a man to marry, that's seeing them as chattels and seeing them as property of the community rather than property themselves entitled to decide whether they want half of this guy or all of that guy, so to speak. Anyway, but it did seem to me an interesting that if you think in our society, we really see it both ways, that when we're thinking, and you professionally see it both ways, that after all, who is a crime committed against? If somebody murders me, who legally speaking was that crime committed against? State of California, right? That's the Blotchron way of looking at it. On the other hand, if somebody violates a contract with me or dents my tar, that's a tort, that's an offense against me. So it's as if we sort of come hardwired with two ways of looking at the world, one of which is a way in terms of individual rights and obligations, and one of which is a way that's in terms of some kind of groups, this imaginary person called the State of California, and so forth. I mean, if people complain about the fact that corporations are treated as people in our legal system, governments, in a sense, are treated as people too, and they're even less plausible candidates for that job. So, it sounds as though the Blotchram system, aside from sort of the equivalent of legal issues, is more centralized in that you have this big extended family living together. It's fairly well defined who are the high status people. The grandfather is probably the elder, eldest generation is starting running it. Whereas again, the Roman child seemed to be more or less on our standard model of individual families running around. One thing which occurred to me reading the gypsy stuff, I'm not sure if it works or not, is that it makes sense to think of gypsies as hunter-gatherers, as modern hunter-gatherers. That the human lifestyle up to about 8,000 or 9,000 years ago was a hunter-gatherer lifestyle, which we have bands of 80 people or something wandering around in some mixture of foraging and hunting and such. And the question is, would it make sense to conceptualize the gypsies as modern hunter-gatherers? It's just that we're the jungle. That is to say, they're hunter-gatherers, and we are the people they are hunting and gathering from. The non-gypsy human population provides lots of opportunities for legally or illegally getting stuff you want. And it occurred to me that I've never had a paper on this, but that if there's enough information in the anthropological literature, it would be nice to know how hunter-gatherers run their affairs. So what is known about in modern surviving hunter-gatherer tribes, how does their legal system? So if somebody doesn't have a good idea for a paper, and especially if anybody has more background in anthropology than I do, what? That would be one. But there are a lot. I mean, there are Central American. There are Central American and South American and African, I think, examples. And there's Papua New Guinea. So I think you would find a number of places. And what I don't know is whether there's an anthropologist who sort of said, well, look at all of these cases. Here are the patterns you observe. But if there is, that would be a fun thing to do a paper on. One of the features of the gypsies, I think, is deliberate illiteracy, in the sense that not being literate, at least in the dominant language, again provides a barrier. It means that people are less likely to read about how this Marmé stuff is complete nonsense, and you know it's germs that cause disease and stuff like that. The Amish, it's not the same thing. The Amish are literate. They can read just fine. They can read in at least two different languages, maybe three languages. But on the other hand, they don't want their kids to go to urban high schools with the rest of us. on the grounds that that will, I think, acculturate them. Yeah.
With the Amish, though, don't they not want the children to go to college? If you remember,
they only go through eighth grade, neither high school nor college.
Right, but they're actually forbidden to go to college, if I remember right.
That is, you know, it's a little tricky to know in what sense they're forbidden, because, of course, the children don't have to be Amish until they decide to be. But I think it is probably correct that the ordinum of almost all congregations would not permit going to college. I think that's right. But they also don't permit high school. That was what the original big fight in the first half of the 20th century was over, was Amish parents refusing to send their children to high school and going to jail. And there was famous picture of some Amish kids diving into a cornfield in order to avoid the people who were trying to collect them and so forth. Yeah.
I'm just thinking about what you're saying, like analogy of gypsies to the gathering. And I was thinking from the gatherers in general and why people are coming to gatherers. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that you don't have to settle down to become a sedentary people. You don't have to, because you have a wealth of food and the warm weather. I think it was Jared Diamond was saying something about Native American populations in the United States and how there are actually societies in the Southeast, but not so much in California. Because the weather was nice, there weren't that many people that close to them fighting, so you got all these environmental things that go into it. So if you were to compare gypsies to hunter-gatherers and saying that they're feeding off of population, you know, people, then it would seem like the ones that develop societies like Chris, where you have your own that are a little less nomadic, would be in places where there's less people to feed off.
Might be. Although I think it sounds as though their stopping being nomadic wasn't their idea. It was a matter of the people, of the locals grabbing them, I think. Though, again, I've never really read a history of what happened in Romania. I've just seen the description in this book, and that would be another interesting question to look at. Yeah, no, there certainly are people who argue that hunter-gatherer lifestyle was really not so bad. And the argument then, though, is not the reason you quit is that you find agriculture is better, but the reason you quit is that agriculture maintains a much denser population, and so whoever does convert to agriculture gradually pushes the hunter-gatherers out because you outnumber them 10 to 1.
They all seem to be environmental considerations, like not just literally the environment, but you know, what other populations you have.
Yeah,
that, geographical things that allow you to become a sedentary population, that allow you to farm.
But, of course, the other thing in North America was that until fairly late, you didn't have any food crops that were adequate for farming. Basically, the New World food crops, which are maize, squash, a few other things, beans, are developed in, I think, well, potatoes are in South America, but I think the others, I think, are Central America, and gradually work their way up. This is, again, the Diamond, I have mixed views of Diamond, but he makes an interesting point that basically crops can move much more easily east-west than north-south, because north-south the climate is changing. And that it's, I mean, our whole picture of the Indians is in a sense, of the North Americans, in a sense all wrong, because it includes horses, which they didn't have until the 16th century or whenever they got, I guess probably the 16th century, when enough of the Spanish horses got loose and bred and started coming up. And it includes food crops, which they got a couple hundred years earlier than that. So that, I don't know the exact date, but prior to something like 1200, I'm not sure there was an alternative to being hunter-gatherer if you were very far north, just because of not having crops that agriculture worked for. But yeah, anyway, it just struck me that sort of they're nomadic, they don't engage in agriculture, the gypsies, they mostly... It's not clear in what sense they own property. That's one of the things you do get, which also struck me as interesting, because it was a case of gypsy law, I suspect in violation of U.S. law, is market division. That apparently it's quite common that gypsy groups agree among themselves on who gets to be the fortune teller's where, essentially. That's our territory. You aren't allowed to trespass in it. Now, I assume, isn't that in violation of antitrust laws? It seems as though it ought to be. But presumably they can get away with it. And part of the system, I think, is you have a group that's sufficiently coherent and isolated so that it can force its own rules, but another part is sufficiently isolated so that the greater society can't keep track of it very well, and therefore it can get away with things. And again, it's pretty clear from the book that some of the things that gypsies do, such as the important person in the family has committed a crime, so someone else will volunteer to confess for it, and the rest of us will all support him and treat him very nice when he gets out. Yeah.
One thing that puzzled me about the Finnish gypsies, again, is the lacking of a centralized system for administering justice. And given the fact that feuds can start out and then they seem like they can continue indefinitely, it seems to me hard to imagine a situation where a feud would end. So logically, you could imagine the Finnish gypsies to be completely riven by these ancient blood feuds that have no effective end. Even though they're not killing each other, it's simply the case, well, we remember old grandfather X was, you know, rudely assaulted in the street by X, by Y, and we've hated that family ever since.
There's a couple of things. First, one point that's worth noting about different feud systems is that it matters whether feuds have a termination. So that one approach, and this is the Comanche approach, is basically, I kill you, your relatives kill me, we all recognize it's over now. That's been paid. As opposed to what's being described in the Kali case, where I did something to you, your kin maybe, if they didn't avoid, they maybe did something to one of our people, and now we owe you another one. But it sounded, what he was saying, as though what was really going on was just time. That, time wounds all heals, as somebody put it. That by a generation or so later, nobody remembers quite what the feud was about or why, and by that time they've forgotten it. And also it's, that is, I guess you are having a single continuous family in a sense, even though the genes are half from somewhere else. Yeah, you were going to?
Well, I was just going to ask a question.
Right.
If you know, like, about the roles that this is allowed to perform in society, like jobs, you said that they don't farm. You know, and I think a lot of that comes down to being a person giving people who can't have land, and so can't have land, and don't become agricultural. And I see a lot of similarities with to people see the way you're marginalized and people do, so then you start filling a role in society.
Yes.
And that needs people, you know, so that means that you have to go to the cities, and you have to be in places where there's a lot of people that are outsiders to your experience, and then the need for protection, and more protection of who you are. Whereas if you live out in the countryside, you can have a little more openness, a little more freedom on being who you are, as compared to
maybe
being in Vienna or something.
Yeah, it might be. My impression is the gypsies often were basically migratory across the countryside. That's at least the impression one gets from the medieval accounts of the gypsies. And nowadays, I think they're largely in cities. And part of that may, of course, be the welfare system to provide a nice way for hunter-gatherers to live off their environment if they can do a good job of scamming the system because it can't keep track of them and they can keep track of it. I don't know enough. It's clear that sort of to Americans, the gypsies are sort of an interesting exotic story, whereas it's pretty clear that in parts of Eastern Europe, they're the same kind of issue that Americans see Afro-Americans, or it's probably the most obvious minority, but other groups, as the sort of thing where the population is divided. When people say they're getting a raw deal, we ought to be better to them. And people say, no, they're parasites, and we wish they'd all go away somehow. And I think both of those are happening. Yeah.
There's an interesting conflict of law. In Hungary, there isn't a passing constitution. They have a weird system. You get a majority of conservatives.
Yeah, and the EU is threatening to do all sorts of things to them.
Yeah, so they just passed it. It's really, really Christian-oriented, and it says, and somewhere in it that they want to give people the freedom to work as they're able to. You know, they want to have as many people as productive as possible. But specifically the gypsies, they pass some law trying to make everybody of working age work, trying to force them into labor because they viewed it as a measure taken against gypsies to get them to be productive. They assume Hungarians are going to work, but they need to put in some legal measures to make
Them work or to not give them welfare if they don't work. It's somewhat
the combination of the two, but they're kind of worried that it runs counter to their laws where they're saying we're not going to force anybody into any type of labor, especially coming out of a post-communist country where everyone's worried that the government's going to make you do something, but then everybody passes a law to make people do something.
But if the law makes them work, or if the law is just like you have various patterns in the U.S. which basically say you're not entitled to welfare if you could get a job and refuse to.
You have to try to work, and so then there's a conflict of people that are saying it's better for us to be on welfare and we don't want to work in this occupation with these people. And it's very similar. I think it's a lot of the things that they try to do to remedy the problems that are near what you do in the United States.
Well, I know the term workfare was used quite a long time ago. There was some town in New York State, this is probably 20 or 30 years ago, which had what, according to who you believed, was or wasn't a successful program, which basically said, we will give you welfare only, we will not give you welfare if we offer you work that the city wants done and you refuse to do it, basically. So, which has certain logic to it, but so that kind of issue is going to come. Yeah, now what's going to happen to the gypsies will be very interesting. I mean, say in the case of the Amish, basically they only survived in North America as a group. And the gypsies, maybe that'll happen. Maybe we're going to end up that the gypsy population will gradually seep out of Europe. France, I think, was trying to remove gypsies, as I remember. Right? Wasn't it France that was offering to pay them to leave?
Yeah, that's a huge problem because one of the things about being a Romanian is you watch the local news and it's all the Romanians leaving to go to Poland for jobs, and you watch BBC and it's all the Poles going to England for jobs.
Yes, right.
And there's lots of Romanians that move to Italy because of the shared linguistics.
Yes.
So you don't really have to learn that much.
Yep.
So I remember there was a big issue because now with the free movement of workers, if you say people in Serbia don't really want to go to England because their parents are in Serbia, or people in Romania don't want to go elsewhere, well, if the gypsy population feels unsettled, or is that migratory, they can go anywhere they want.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think that was part of the problem in Paris, was that they were going to move them out, you know, but where are they going to go? They can go anywhere they want. So if Paris pushing them away is going to become Berlin's problem, or, you know.
Yep.
So they have a lot of problems with that, too, the balance.
Yep. Well, in a way, it relates to the whole question of immigration for the U.S., that one of the argument, people who sort of in general are in favor of free markets tend to be in favor of free immigration. That's just, you know, free labor market. And then the counter argument that's made to that is, that's fine in a laissez-faire society, but if you have a welfare state, now if you have free immigration, people will come here not because they want to do anything useful, because they want to live off us. But the counter argument to that is, that makes having a welfare state more politically expensive if you have free immigration. So you might argue, yes, indeed, the welfare state is an argument against free immigration, but free immigration is also an argument against the welfare state, and if you don't like welfare states, that becomes another argument for free immigration. So that's sort of a complicated set of relations. Yep.
Would you restate the argument?
Sure. Let me take it in steps. Start out as somebody who in general likes free markets, laissez-faire, that sort of stuff. And you say, well, obviously one part of a free market is that workers can take their labor wherever somebody wants to hire it. So you ought to have free immigration, which was the U.S. policy, after all, until the 1920s, with few exceptions, mainly for Orientals on the West Coast. But as you presumably know, you know, this whole idea that restrictive immigration sort of is preserving America, unrestricted immigration is what made America. That, you know, the Statue of Liberty has got this poem, which is sort of a paean to poor, filthy, uneducated people coming to our shores to find freedom. And I suggested a long time ago that we ought to give the French back the statue since we no longer believed in its principles. And it was only in the 1920s that the U.S. started putting in serious restrictions on immigration. With the exception that on the West Coast there were some immigration, some restrictions on Oriental immigration earlier than that. And the argument, if you like free markets, you say, well, there should be a free market for labor. People should be free to go where they want. But then somebody who said that the people who agree with you mostly but don't like immigration say, well, that would be a fine idea in a world of where the only way you could make income was by making something valuable and selling it to someone else, because then immigrants come, wonderful. If there's somebody who will mow my lawn, which I don't want to do myself, he will benefit by the transaction, I'll benefit by the transaction, great deal. And then the counter argument is, but what if he doesn't do that? What if he comes in order to go on welfare and collect your taxes? Now you're not so happy about having people coming in. And that's obviously been part of the French and Eastern European concern with the gypsies. But then a possible counter-argument to that, if you don't like the idea of welfare states in general, if you think that government redistribution is not a great idea, you say, great, once we have free immigration, now the people who are in favor of welfare states are going to realize they aren't going to work anymore, because if they try to be generous to the local poor, they'll just pull in all of the world's poor, so they'll stop having welfare states, we'll have a laissez-faire society, with a laissez-faire society, we can have free immigration. And, of course, the final step in the argument is to say, well, you may say that abolishing a welfare state is bad for the poor, but just think about the fact that the existence of the welfare state is keeping people much poorer than the American poor out of America, where if they came into America, they'd be much better off. But if you think about the mass immigration of the late 19th and early 20th century, in a sense, that was one of the greatest successes in raising human welfare in history. We were bringing a million people a year out of poverty in Europe, most of them, into what in a generation became, you know, prosperous middle-class life in America. Anyway, it's a complicated argument, but it's what I get involved in sometimes. I think it's sort of an intriguing multiple stages of A causes B, but B causes C, but C causes D kind of analysis, which is worth thinking about. And of course, going back for a moment to the sense in which gypsy law only protects gypsies, one of the weird things about American politics is the way people can, with a straight face, both want to restrict immigration and say they're trying to help the poor. And of course, the invisible word is American. That is, they want to restrict immigration to protect the American poor from the competition of foreigners who might take the same jobs at lower wages. But that's protecting the American poor at the expense of the Indian, Mexican, Chinese poor, as it were. But all of us, in a sense, have sort of hardwired in this kind of group identification such that the out-group doesn't count, so to speak, right? We have this very strong instinctive tendency, I think, to say we do our moral calculation only on us, not on them. And anyway, it's getting pretty far from this subject, but it just struck me for a long time, this sort of odd tension. Yep.
Yeah, you could look at the effect of the amount of resources on society to kind of how they handle this immigration or any other issues. If there's an abundance of resources, the legal system is different than society with scarcity.
There's a problem, though, with abundance of resources, because in modern societies, the main resource is us, is people.
Yeah, that I didn't even know if we took away the immigration controls.
Well, the U.S. is empty by world standards. Look, Hong Kong managed in, 20 or 30 years to move from a very poor country to a higher per capita income than England. Hong Kong had 10 times the population density of the most densely populated country in the world, which was Singapore at the time. It's got a good harbor. That's about it. It imported drinking water. So I think the idea that in modern society, now your statement is really much... Your statement is true with regard to oil-producing countries in the Middle East, where the natural resource really is a major source of income. It's probably true through much of past history. But at this point, I think if you look at countries, it just isn't true that, in general, densely populated countries are poor and loosely populated countries are rich. That's somewhat both ways. That the U.S. and Canada have very low populations and they're rich. Belgium and the Netherlands have very high population densities, and they're rich too. Some of the African countries have very low population densities.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking of more if someone's caught stealing in a scarcer environment versus a more abundant resource.
Yes.
Are the repercussions for stealing?
That's an interesting question, and actually, that to some extent goes to the society we're not covering this year because they had too many, which is the Cheyenne Indians. Or the Plains Indians in general, because it's odd, sort of from our standpoint, but if you read The Cheyenne Way, which is the book on the Cheyenne Indians, they sound like rich people. They're rich people who are at risk of starving to death, given their environment. But they're rich people in the sense that when things went well, they had more horses than they needed. So you've got this, I don't know if I mentioned, there's this fascinating little vignette where the Cheyenne have a system where during the summer the whole tribe comes together. They can't feed the whole tribe during the winter in that place. And one of the things they do is a group buffalo hunt. And one of the rules of the group buffalo hunt is that nobody can go after the buffaloes until everybody does. There's a sort of a group of people, of police, so to speak, who are in charge of controlling the hunt. And one of the standard things for sort of teenagers out to show how brave they are to do is to break the rules. And you've got a scene where there are a couple of, where the police, so to speak, before the hunt, see a couple of young men who are off hunting buffalo. And they ride down on them like thunder. and the young men sort of cower and don't defy them or anything of the sort, and they shoot the horses of the young men. They tear up their blankets. They smash their guns. Young men do nothing to object. They act as if they understand that they're guilty people who are being punished for their offenses. At which point, one of the attackers says, look, here are these two boys out on the prairie with no horses, no blankets, no guns. What are we going to do? And one of them says, well, look, I got a spare horse. I can give one of them a horse. And one of them says, well, I got a spare horse, too. I can give one of them. I got an extra gun. And having destroyed all of their stuff, they then basically replace it. And that feels like a society where it's critical that the boys behave as if they understand that they're bound by the rules. They've been breaking a rule, they've been caught breaking the rule, and they don't defend themselves. But once that's established, the society is rich enough so that people are in a position to essentially give away with surplus goods of their own. And that struck me sort of it doesn't seem natural for us to think of Plains Indians as rich people, because by our terms, obviously, they weren't rich. But in terms of the resources that mattered to them, as long as things weren't going badly, as long as it wasn't a harsh winter or something, they had more than they needed. And that, I think, got reflected in their legal and social patterns. And you get the description in a number of the Plains Indians, I think including the Cheyenne, they don't worry about theft. That basically the sort of the response is, you stole that? You should have asked me for it. I would have given it to you. And that sort of being a thief is low status, but that's the only cost to it. Yeah.
I think that those two things tie in, though, like, well, how much harm can be did based on how many resources you have within society. Societies value resources differently. I can have rocks in my country, he can have rocks in his country, depending on who we are, we might value them differently. Yep. And the political system to me is an allocation of resources. You know, the kind of continuous function of a political system, in my view, is to say, you have oil here, these people want oil, these people want oil, we're going to figure out a way that we can work collaboratively to allocate our own resources. And because the political system functions within the legal system, then you kind of have to have a tie-in. There's always going to be a tie-in between those two.
I'm not sure in what sense political systems generally act to allocate resources, because there are surely lots of contexts in which people say, well, the allocation of resources is already given. We already know who owns the land. And we would rebel if the king decided, no, I'm going to take your land and give it to him. So, do I mean,
but that's still within the legal. If you have a king, the king is top of the legal structure from whom the political structure is formed.
Well, that doesn't describe a feudal system, because in the feudal system, the king doesn't have nearly as many knights who will fight for him as the lords do. So it's not as simple. I mean, it seems to me that you're in a sense imagining 17th century absolute monarchy back in the 12th century, and that if you think about, I would, to me at least, though this is probably not the correct political science term, the defining feature of a feudal society, which again has nothing to do with a feud society, is that the critical resource is controlled far enough down so the people at the top are coalition leaders. And I think that describes feudal Europe. What's the key? That depends. The critical resource in that society was heavy cavalry. But I would argue that U.S. Big city machines in the 19th century or the early 20th century were feudal as well. It's just that the critical resource was votes, the ability to deliver votes. So that the city boss was really the coalition leader of the various people who in various parts of the city had done enough favors for people and in various other ways had people in that area who would vote the way they told them to. And so I think that's feudal too.
Like in the feudal system, and how do you mobilize those? You're saying that the resources traced down the cavalry.
Yep.
Which I understand are under the feudal lords, which are under whatever.
But under is a complicated statement, because the king doesn't have a blank check.
No, he doesn't have a blank check, but how does he keep them, these men? I keep these, you know, because in that system, if you're the king of England, you have to keep all these people in check, and you have to fight against.
If you're competent, you're a good coalition leader, and if you're competent.
What are you allocating, though?
Well, you have some. Partly you have some resources of your own, but partly what you're doing is offering coordination. You're saying, look, how about him and you and I do this, and look, that guy was a nuisance to you, let's smush him, and now you feel loyal to me, and sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't, obviously. Now, the figure that I remember spreading me a long time ago, was, and again, it's at some point, 12th century, 13th century, that the feudal levy of Normandy was larger than the feudal levy of France. All right, Normandy was... The Duke of Normandy was a feudal inferior of the King of France. But what the Duke of Normandy owed the King of France was not all the knights he had, it was a fixed number of knights that he owed for the service for Normandy. And he had a lot more knights than that. and the result was that if you added them up, the knight services that were owed by the inferiors of the Duke of Normandy added up to more knights than the ones who were owed to the King of France. And that was the point at which the French monarchy was not a very strong monarchy.
In that case, what keeps the balance of power? If you have the King of France and then you have Normandy
and
more powerful than France, what keeps that balance of power?
Well,
so that France is not swallowed by Normandy.
Mm-hmm. But of course, there are other, it's not just Normandy. There are a bunch of, you know, Aquitaine is also powerful, and presumably various other provinces are also powerful. And my guess is that at some times, the French king is really the puppet of a couple of the lords who are the strongest people, and at other times the French king is an able, competent intriguer, and he gets him fighting with him, and I'll help you, and so forth. And so it's got to have been a complicated politics, which I think we underestimate how little we understand.
One of the nice things King had was that they got to allocate lands that became unowned by virtue of the fact that the feudal lord died without a male heir. And in that situation, the wife.
They're not allocating the lands, they're allocating the heiress.
Yes, they're allocating the heiress.
The case we were just discussing, in fact, Isabel of Pembroke ends up married to William Marshall because Henry II, who is very much in debt to William Marshall for considerable services, essentially says, you know, here is this heiress, I'll marry her. Actually, I'll give you her custody, whatever the right term is, so you get to decide who she marries. Guess what? I'm going to marry her myself. That's 40 knight services in... That was 40 knight services in Normandy, it was all of the Kingdom of Leinster, and it was Pembroke, which was a Palatine barony on the Welsh Marches. So William sort of overnight goes from being a famous knight errant, so to speak, to being a great lord.
That's a real power.
Yeah, well, that was really... Yeah. No, and there were various other things. There were various... one of the interesting things about the feudal situation, legally speaking, is that I think they had a more realistic view of law as a revenue source than we do. So that you get the pattern where a noble has paid the king for the right to enforce certain parts of the law in his territory. And then when he dies, that right reverts to the king, and his heir has to pay a further fine to get back the right. Because there were certain parts of the law that the feudal lord normally enforced, but then others that didn't. And I think it's pretty clear that they viewed law enforcement as a large part of a revenue source. So, you know, you convict somebody of something, and his property forfeits to the king or to his feudal lord or whatever, and that's very nice if you're the guy who it forfeits to. But anyway, that's a bit of a digression, but I hope an interesting one. So other things about the gypsies before we go on to the Amish next week. See, I've got a whole bunch of notes, but most of it isn't all that interesting. The one interesting question, going back to the point about illiteracy, is to what extent things like radio and television and movies make it harder to maintain culturally isolated groups. Because my impression is, at least that in the U.S., that essentially all gypsies are fluent in English. And am I right in assuming that in Romania or Hungary, they're normally fluent in the local language, just as the Amish both speak Pennsylvania Dutch as their home language and are normally fluent speakers of ordinary English? And once you do that, now it's going to get harder over time to keep people away from movies and television and newspapers earlier than that, and the internet, and so forth. And so, be interesting to see. Of course, you can see it the other way as well, because the internet has the interesting one of the interesting things about the internet is that it could either increase or decrease cultural diversity. Because on the one hand, the internet means that you can interact with people other than your neighbors. And so, if you are a gypsy living with gypsies, but you're really curious about the world, you could have a bunch of secret friends who weren't gypsies at all. But it also means that if you are a member of some weird group, whether that's a geek or a believer in some small minority religion, you can interact online with the 90,000 other people who out of the whole world are the only people who are like you. And I don't want to talk to all those people. I mean, they're weird. I mean, you know, they believe in whatever it is that we don't believe in. So you've got the possibility both for more factionalization via non-geographic communities and for less. And I don't know how that's going to play out eventually. But
presumably we'll get to see. One of the features of the law, of gypsy law, is it's an oral system. And, of course, some governmental legal systems have been oral as well. The argument, I thought it was sort of amusing, the gypsies play, one argument, at least according to the book, that the gypsies offer for their superiority is, look, our legal system has stayed the same forever and yours keeps changing. But, of course, nobody knows if it stays the same forever because there's no written documents to check it on. And it seems unlikely that it's really true. And you could argue that's a virtue of oral law, that one of the features we'll come to when we get to Iceland that I thought was sort of cute about the Icelandic system. Icelandic law first gets written down in, I think, the 12th or maybe 13th century. But for a long period of time, the system is that there is one government employee in Iceland, part-time, who is the law speaker, the lögsögumaður. And part of his responsibility is to memorize the law code. He has a 3-year term of office, and he is supposed to publicly recite a third of the law code each year at the Althing, the national gathering. And supposedly, if he leaves something out in his recitation and nobody objects, it's out. So it's sort of an early form of sunset legislation. And one would think that to some extent you would restrict the complication of legal systems by their having to be memorized, as that one did. And it's pretty clear, if you read the sagas, that knowing the law was actually a valuable piece of intellectual property, so that you will have a few people who show up as characters in the sagas, of whom it said, you know, he knew the law so well that it was said that no case was really finally settled unless he had had a hand in it to make sure it was right. And you have cases where some bright young man goes to essentially be the adopted son of somebody somewhere else because that somebody's an expert in the law and he's going to learn the law and sort of inherit that set of skills. One of the most famous of the sagas, Njal's saga. Njal's sons are great warriors. Njal is not a warrior at all. He is an expert in the law. Yep.
One thing that seems interesting about oral, like having a system of oral laws, is, especially in relation to the gypsies, is that they're a polyglot society. Like, if you have people in Romania and the gypsies in France, I'd be interested to see how the laws change. Like, are they, you know, do they, when they go into press, do they only
The answer is that in Chris, at least according to this source, they do it in a version of Romania, but not the standard version of Romania. And sort of like if you think about law French, I guess was one of the court French they called it that was used in England.
So is that kind of standardized among people along, or is that?
That is I think it is clear that there is a Gypsy language, Romania, that it has dialects. And probably like most other such cases, like your Romanians and Italians, they are partly mutually comprehensible, but not entirely. Right? So they're not going to be identical. And I don't know whether the form that's used in the Chris, which is really a more archaic form, whether that's more nearly comparable across them or not. I mean, that's how Latin was used in the Middle Ages, of course, because everybody knew Latin, everybody meaning all educated people, which is a small minority, even if their native languages were English, French, German, and so forth. So.
Well, that's how we ended up with Spanish. You know, the spread of all the Latin. You have one thing, this is the law supposed to be in.
No, but French and Spanish are from places that were under Roman rule.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying.
But German students in a German university in the Middle Ages were speaking Latin, too. So were English students speaking Latin, because Latin was the international language, just as English is becoming the international language now. It's just that at the same time that Latin-descended languages, Romanian, Italian, Spanish, French, were the local languages.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So if you had gypsy groups that were moving around and you're speaking this one form of your language that you're supposed to use in legal context,
yes.
How often that changes in regional variations?
Don't know. Don't know.
Could you ever know that?
Don't know.
Thinking about the gypsies and how little people actually know.
Yep.
That would be something you could figure out.
Yes, it could be figured out, but whether it has to be.
One of the things we talked about in the first class was how these governments scale. And
how the systems scale, you mean?
The legal systems scale. And so it would be interesting to me to know what the maximum carrying capacity of the gypsy legal system would be. And it seems like it wouldn't be very big.
that it sounds though it in fact isn't, in the sense that it sounds from this description as though the Vlachram don't really have a single legal system, even though they think they do, in that it's the a particular Christ or a particular community that decides, you know, that generates their equivalent of common law, as it were, of judge-made law, and there's no written document. So one question is how large it could scale, but the other question is just if they don't have mechanisms to keep it consistent. If I take, again, I think the Amish we'll look at next. The Amish, we know the answer. The answer is that in the case of the Amish, the enforceable legal unit is a single congregation, district of up to 40 households. The effective unit of uniformity is the affiliation, which is a group of congregations which have each decided that will be affiliated with the others. Yeah. Yes.
On one hand, you think it might kind of go do away kind of with a lot of the insulation of the society, but at the same time, you know, the different societies, like linguistically, you're talking about through isolation that their languages form dialects and then differ further, but with the increase of modern technology, that the various disparate Romani groups can communicate with each other, perhaps
they might get a more uniform
way, right, just to maintain their culture in a more uniform way.
But it's not clear that the uniformity is necessary to the survival of the culture. It's managed very well on diversity.
More isolation, more just communication between groups to reinforce.
So that you might have something where the individual Romani groups are in a sense less tight, but the Romani as a people as a whole are more so. Right.
Just to maintain.
The Vlach can talk to the colleague if they want to.
Right. Because I was wondering, reading the Finnish stuff, like how long have these groups been?
Several hundred years.
To develop these different legal systems.
Yes.
Maybe even still keep the same.
I think the answer is, I think not. I have to go back and look because I read it a while ago. My memory is that the Kali are not mutually comprehensible with the other groups, even though it's the same language in the sense of a descendant. I mean, I don't think that a native speaker of Italian can automatically speak Spanish. It's just a whole lot easier to learn Spanish than.
Right, right. Maybe I'll get complicated with each other, though.
Yeah, maybe. Yes.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like the preservation of certain aspects of your culture, like through media or. Like, look at MTV. There's the one channel or Coca-Cola. It's one thing you kind of find everywhere. Like, American culture, we have 900 channels on our TV, but the second you go to Belgium, they get, like, 10 American channels, and it's always the same thing. Like, we're perpetuating the same ideas about American culture around the world, and it kind of brings, it alienates people as to what we're really like, what Californians are like as compared to New Yorkers, but it does educate them as to what Americans value, or a certain section of Americans value, enough to put on TV elsewhere in the world. Clearly that they value as well because they're willing to pay for it. You know, Comedy Central, or there's a variety of things that you find everywhere throughout the world, and it's weird because it preserves American culture.
Yeah. But you do end up with I think Europeans seeing American culture as much more uniform and as having a lot more cowboys and gangsters than it really does.
Yeah, well, that's how you get that perception, because that's what we're willing to, like, codify the people.
Though I think it may be true even before the television. I'm remembering, like, quite a long time ago, 20 or 30 years ago it must have been, I was invited to be part of some kind of a conference in Paris. I forget what it was on. And a little while before it happened, it turned out that somebody had been invited to speak at it who some of the other people thought was a fascist. I think he was probably associated with Le Pen, if you're familiar with that movement, but something like that. And so a bunch of the American people pulled out in protest. And my reaction was, if he was really a fascist, I really wanted to meet him because I never had a chance to argue with a fascist and find out what their views really were. So I went. And I ended up talking, I'm not sure if it was that guy or somebody connected with him. Maybe somebody was part of the same movement who I had dinner with. And it was really fascinating because he sort of was idealizing classical antiquity and seeing Christianity as what had sort of destroyed the wonders of classical Europe. But he also saw America as sort of wall-to-wall McDonald's stands and, you know, had a terrible cultural effect in debasing the culture of Europe. So I told him a good deal about my hobby, which is medieval historical recreation and cooking from 14th century cookbooks and stuff like that, and I think he found that somewhat inconsistent with his picture of what America was like. But of course, one of the neat things about America and probably other places is it is a whole bunch of little tiny worlds that... So that would be another interesting subject, figuring out how those worlds run themselves. If you think about the world of people who do medieval historical recreation, which is one of mine, the world of mineral collectors, which is my wife's parents' world, the world of bridge players, which is my sister and her husband's world, the world of horse people, which is my sister's world, and umpteen, there's poker world, and each of these, in some sense, feels like a full human society, that people know each other, they've got friends, you've sort of, it's almost as though you've got a village which happens to be several thousand miles across and very spread out, and yet socially feels very much like a village. Anyway, I think it's time for us all to go and read about the Amish and talk about more stuff. But I am going to try as best I can to avoid the temptation to just follow a whole set of outline notes and preach at you, because it's more fun if you can follow.
No, it's undoubtedly rich, and it will see these comments about how people actually look at mass market. They've done sociological studies in Israel. It's one of these nice, very radically different population social groups in Israel. And they have them watching the same programs, and they fill out these questionnaires after the fact. And their attitudes towards what they've seen are completely different. They see the exact same thing, but their interpretation of what's going on, the moral content of the episode, the important lessons you can learn from them, are completely like this. It's as though they're watching different episodes. So
I've seen people do sort of a spoofs, pro-Sauron accounts of the Lord of the Rings, you know, where Sauron is obviously the good guy, and you've got these anti-technological elves trying to destroy his industrial revolution and so forth. So that would, in a way...